Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I'm your host, Graham Culbertson, and the guest today, Leonard Williams. You know, you weren't my first guest on this podcast, maybe not the second. I should have looked this up, but you were, I would say, in probably my first five guests all the way back talking about the crossword puzzle book. You're also a political scientist, and I'll just give you a moment to introduce yourself, and then we'll start talking about the Donald Trump regime in the United States of America, which is what we're here to talk about.
Right. It's good to be with you again. I believe that was the 13th episode. So I don't know in what order you recorded them, but it was pretty early on in that first year. As I've said, I've been listening to you ever since, enjoying all kinds of things, learning about games, for example, things that I don't really encounter much. I am a retired political scientist now after couple of years of teaching after the pandemic. I decided that I had had enough of the routine and the scheduling and the grading, all the things that you know very well as someone still in the academy. So I've been retiring. I finished a book on ideology. I've just been doing occasional op-eds, a Substack that combines politics and crosswords. So I keep busy.
All right. Well, one of the things you did that kept you busy was, we're recording this in December of 2025. The episode will come out in either January or early February of 2026. So a little over a year ago, you recorded a podcast episode about, you know, responding to the Trump election. I'll let you say a bit about that. But first, I want to say, I mean, I just re-listened to it. And you were, you know, forecasting what was coming. You mentioned that there would be a strengthening of executive power and a reduction in the number of people who would check Trump within the executive branch. There would be an assault on the federal regulatory bodies and just attacks on the civil service, that there would be a big crackdown on people who are here either illegally or in some cases, as you mentioned, people who are not here illegally, but nevertheless will be caught up in deportation procedures. And as far as I can tell, you were right about all of those things. Having just listened to it, the only thing that you mentioned that I think was less complete, let's say, in terms of Trump's authoritarianism, was a crackdown on protests and censorship. And we definitely have had censorship of people, especially around Charlie Kirk, and crackdown on protests. But it does seem that's the one place where things like the No Kings protest, and there are some places where the media is still free. On the other hand, if you look at things like CBS News and Jimmy Kimmel and Stephen Colbert, that stuff happened as well. So let me just say, before we say anything else, Leonard, you were recording this in November before the second Trump administration started. You're a political scientist. You've been paying attention. And I would say you pretty accurately forecast what was going to happen in 2025.
Well, I don't claim any special talent. I'm no prognosticator. In fact, my election predictions usually are terribly wrong and totally off base. But I think the signs were there. I was asked to record an Anarchist Essays podcast by the folks at the Anarchism Research Group in Loughborough in the UK. And I naturally agreed. It sounded like a good idea, but the signs were pretty clear that there would be that strengthening of executive power. That's all laid out in Project 2025, the Heritage Foundation's Mandate for Leadership book, which they began back in the Reagan era. The Democratic backsliding was very evident. You know, that had been written about even during the first term, with the breaking of norms and just the excesses of right-wing populism. The realization of a reactionary project that began really back, you know, 60 or so years ago with the Goldwater campaign, and as you can track it all the way through to the birthplace of, and the birth, rather, I should say, of the Tea Party and the MAGA movement. And then what I called in the essay an avalanche of abominations, as you mentioned, the mass deportation effort was clearly going to be one that wasn't targeted, wasn't selective. And if anything, it's been more cruel than I imagined at the time, because they've kind of set loose not so much a paramilitary group, but one that operates like one within the government. So it was all pretty clear, I think, at that point that, the direction they were headed, based upon the kinds of people who were supporting Trump this time around, the kinds of people that he was going to bring into the administration. Those people were in the wings waiting to come on stage. So I don't claim any special talent for predicting things, but I think it was pretty clear for most observers where we were headed. What wasn't so clear, as you were pointing out, was that there would be the kind of crackdown on institutions and organizations that we've seen, and the willingness of some of them to just kind of capitulate almost in advance. The obey in advance thing that folks talk about. The legal firms, the in Washington, the media outlets, one institution after another, including higher education institutions. So that's been problematic. And the sheer reliance upon power and power alone. The justification for the things that they've done in Chicago and Los Angeles and Charlotte and everywhere else and DC, all of that is just justified simply because we're in charge. And if you don't like it, lump it.
Yeah, I mean, so a couple things. So first of all, I'll just say, we talked a moment ago, before we started rolling that I'm, hoping to keep this to under an hour. We could easily have spoken for an hour every day. Every day we could have spoken for an hour about what the Trump administration is flooding the zone with. So we're gonna have to, this is gonna be a dreadfully incomplete conversation. This past year has been, I mean, it was beyond my belief. The second thing is, and this is just where I have to say that I was wrong. I'm not sure I was wrong publicly, although I probably was on the podcast. I haven't gone back, but I wasn't expecting the Trump administration to be as bad as you outlined, the second Trump administration, because although it wasn't as well and coherently laid out with Project 2025, the claims Trump made for his first administration were not too far out of line with what he said he was going to do in this one. And then the first Trump administration, barely rose to the level of George W. Bush. And so I just thought we were going to get another Republican, standard Republican administration with lots of horrible tweets. And as you have pointed out, I wasn't paying close enough attention. All the writing was there. It was never going to be that. I was emailing James Fallows about this, and he said roughly the same thing you said. And I just have to say, I thought we were going to have another annoying, frustrating Republican presidency, and we have gotten something much closer to American authoritarianism. One thing that we may want to pick up is what do we call this? Right-wing populism, authoritarianism, white supremacy, fascism. I mean, these terms are all out there. They all apply to some extent, and but I don't know. So that's just that's what I wanted to say. And then I just wanted to hear from there what you most wanted to highlight about what's happened in the past year and what you're seeing.
Right. You made some really good points there that I think are worth talking about further. One is that it's very, very easy for us to get swept up in the details, the day-to-day stories about what he posted on Truth Social, what he said in at a press conference, all these other things. You know, what I try to do, particularly in writing an opinion piece or writing my Substack, is to try to focus on the long-term issues, the things of greatest significance. Give things time to appear, time to process them, and not try to be in a rapid response mode, in a day-to-day news mode, because that way just seems to make me feel A, anxious, and B, just totally mad. There's no way you can keep track, because the problems keep coming up over and over again. There's a excellent website called the Trump Action Tracker that tries to categorize and account for all of the authoritarian actions the Trump regime's taking. And here we are, like 11 months into the regime, and there are over 2,000 that have been tracked. And half of them deal with violations of the rule of law or use of the state against dissenters or, you know, the culture war things that we often talk about. So it's incredible. There's very, very hard to keep up with the day-to-day things. You want to focus on what's meaningful, what concerns you most, and let the rest go to some extent. Let other people take care of that. So that's one thing to note. The second thing to note, I think, is that when you're trying to come to terms with it, there are lots and lots of ways to kind of categorize it, pigeonhole it, label it in some way. And you mentioned a few, right? Right-wing populism, authoritarianism, his focus on, you know, fascist rhetoric, the culture wars, the white nationalism, the Christian nationalism, everything is all there. Some people talk about MAGA as a cult. So there are a variety of ways to do it. And I've thought at one point about trying to write a book that covers all of those, that highlights all of the different ways in which we can understand the Trumpist phenomenon. And even that just seems so overwhelming. The thing that I've concluded is that people kind of pick the term that is most meaningful to them, use that concept because that's the way they understand how things work in American society and politics. And that's okay. I don't anymore care what you call it, what frame of reference you want to use, whether it's a psychological one, a sociological one, a political science one, a philosophical one, a religious one, whatever framework works for you is fine by me. The important point is that we focus in on what's being done and how to combat it, how to resist it.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's excellent. The next thing I want to talk about, and then we can start getting a little bit to what we can do, is one of the tricky things, one of the problems that I have in, you know, chatting with people is if I tell people I'm an anarchist, and then I also say that I'm, you know, a democratic socialist or something like that, and they say, like, well, how can you be both of those things? And I mean, the listener to this podcast probably isn't going to have trouble with this, but this is just as we're looking at what the government does in the 21st century, like, a lot of times people will say something like, oh, well, you know, the government is fine if it's a place like Denmark or a place like Norway. And I would say yes and no. I mean, Norway does a lot of drilling for oil and the destruction of the environment in order to provide their social services. Denmark is constantly in the news these days. I mean, if you didn't know before, now you know. Denmark is an imperialist power with respect to Greenland. Denmark has incredibly strict immigration rules. It really does have precisely all of the bad things that government has traditionally done. If government has traditionally meant men with guns who obey the ruler and enforce obedience, Denmark has that. It also works to provide food and shelter and medicine and housing for its people. So Denmark has these two elements that all liberal democratic governments have been supposed to have for the past 100 or 200 years, the helping hand and the hand of force. And my just general reading, I wanted to try this out with you, was when Trump took power, he did his best to stop doing any of the things the government can do to help people, helping them receive education, helping them receive health care, helping them receive food, and then everything the government can do to harm people. I mean, sending men with guns anywhere that the legal system would let him send men with guns, targeting anyone the legal system would let him send. So if we have this, you know, as anarchists, this sort of ambivalence about a modern government that is both the men with guns, the old thing is the guns and the butter, that provides both the guns and the butter, I think the easiest way to understand what Trump is doing is just anytime he can use guns, he will, and anytime the government could help someone, he won't. Is this too simplistic? Because it seems roughly accurate to me.
No, it has a lot of appeal. The one thing I would add by way of a slight modification is that he will help the government, he will use the government to help people if they're of the right sort, right? So the whole Doge effort really didn't achieve the efficiencies in terms of government spending and the like. But what it did do was undermine the government's ability to regulate enterprises like those owned by Elon Musk, right? And get him off the hook for any investigations and legal actions that were going to take place against him under a different kind of administration. Or you look at the Trump Visa card, where you've got if you provide millions of dollars, you'll be on a fast track to U.S. citizenship. At the same time, he's undermine, indeed abolish the constitutional provision that provides for birthright citizenship. So it's kind of a two-track strategy. And in fact, there was an analysis done by someone who lived in Nazi Germany by a lawyer there who noted that, basically you get a dual legal system developing, right? You get one kind of law for the rest of us, for most of us, which is very punitive and very restrictive with very little opportunity to gain some redress of grievances. And you get another form of law that it's very much like crony capitalism, right? If you're among the favored elite, you're going to have all the benefits and none of the restraints, none of the burdens. And so that's really what we're seeing here. But it is part of, I think, again, that 60-year plus effort to totally reframe American society, to get rid of the New Deal and Great Society kind of liberal programs that did help to some degree redress major inequalities in American society. We would be a very different place without the Voting Rights Act and the like. We'd be a very different place without Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. And that's where they're focusing their efforts to try to bring about this kind of regime change. And they're doing it in a variety of mechanisms. One is by sheer force of will, right? Rule by executive orders, almost by decree. And, just abolishing programs like, foreign aid and the like, USAID, on a whim, almost, without any consideration of the value and the benefits and the costs of doing so. And the other, to try to just use the legal system, to use the courts to support and ratify those kinds of executive actions. And that's pretty much what's been happening. You know, we had the Supreme Court undermining the Voting Rights Act. They're about to do it again further. We had the court getting rid of, you know, making it, making insurrection not a disqualification for office, but in fact, a qualification. And we had the court issue the immunity decision that said the president pretty much can do anything he wants without ever being held to account, which totally runs contrary to any kind of original understanding of the constitutional framework we have. So that's really what's giving support for this regime change that we've had, where we have a compliant court, a non-functioning Congress, and an executive willing to use all of the powers that have been given to the executive over the last 60, 70, 80 years since the New Deal. And as a result, there are no checks upon this arbitrary use of executive power, other than the people at large.
Okay, I wanna talk about all that stuff, but before we get to the second half of what you said, I wanna go back to where you said, you know, Trump is using the government to help the people if they're the right sort of people, and I want to see if you agree with me that the right sort of people, as you say, is the elite. It's the oligarchs. There was a promise from Trump that the, you know, quote, real Americans, which is to say the white working class. I mean, we can debate what all this means, but the idea is the Trump promise was the people who have been left behind, the heartland Americas, who Americans who have been left behind as the doctors and lawyers and engineers and immigrants and probably Silicon Valley got ahead, that the Trump administration will stand for those people, the forgotten men and women of America. And there's a sense that Trump's appeal, and I mean, you can say this about Mussolini and Hitler as well, has a socialist ring to it, as long as it's an ethno-socialist ring to it. And like with, well, we don't need to go into Hitler with Mussolini and Hitler and Mussolini in this case, but as far as Trump goes, that sort of, you know, ethno-socialism, socialism for the white worker and fascism for the Jews, the immigrants, the outsiders, that has not been the case. It's been socialism for the rich and fascism for everyone else, including the quote real Americans. Does that sound right to you? Because that's my reading of it.
You know, again, whether debating, we could debate whether fascism is the right word, and people, you know, continue to do that, but by and large, anyone who believed that the populist side of his agenda was uppermost in their mind and was going to be the primary focus of any administration that Trump led was being fooled. Quite obviously, that they were not paying attention. And it's very easy for people to get misled that way. First, because those populist appeals, especially the racial and ethnic ones, the nationalist ones, right, are ones designed to bring you in, to make you feel part of something larger than yourself, make you feel important, and like you're going to get what you want. But of course, they rarely happen. They rarely achieve any results in a concrete way, and often are problematic for you, counter to your authentic or real or economic interests. And, you know, there have been many stories and many analyses that suggest that a lot of recent immigrants to the United States felt that he was talking about other people, not them. That he was going to go after the criminals, the people who got here illegally, who weren't playing by the rules. And as we know, that You know, this deportation effort is picking up people who are trying to follow the rules. They're going to the immigration courts. They're making their asylum claims. And when they do, that's when they get picked up. So it was very easy for people to say he's talking about other people. He's going to use force against those other people, the bad ones. We're the good ones. We'll be okay. And of course, that's never really going to happen. It's going to be one where force is used, where programs are destroyed that hurt everyone, including the ones who provided the votes that made it possible for him to get elected. You know, the disruption of, you know, the Affordable Care Act, of Obamacare, the removal of funds that support rural hospitals, the abolition or undermining of SNAP benefits for those who need food assistance. It's just one thing after another, and the people who are most hurt are those at the bottom end of the economic and class scale.
Yeah, good. No, I think that's right. And, you know, it's both hard to sympathize with the people who voted for Trump, and also easy to understand how one can be misled, especially when it's so hard to, you know, as I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, I was not paying enough close attention to what was happening in the orbit around Trump. I was not expecting this Trump administration, and I am a pretty sophisticated reader, I like to think, of the media. But boy, what did I get this wrong?
Yeah, it's. I think the way our news coverage of political life goes, it tends to be episodic. It doesn't try to connect the pieces of the puzzle for people. So it's easy to get distracted again by the day-to-day stuff and overlook the through line, you know, the signal versus the noise kind of idea. But it's important, I think, at this point, knowing that people have been misled, that we can't necessarily hold it against them. Right. I mean, there are some, the true believers, you know, those are people who you know, should be called out and held to account to some extent. But the rest of the folks who have been, you know, swallowed up or misled, perhaps even folks like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who said as much that she's, you know, fell under the spell. And now it's waking up. The idea really needs to be, okay, how can we develop a vision, develop an alternative narrative, I should say, a sense of a new politics that can bring those in and move in the direction that you and I would like to go.
Yeah. And I'll just say, yeah, I've got an episode coming up soon on Mom, Donnie and Bernie. I mean, I'm very positive about the idea that you can offer a left wing populism, a form of socialism that can bring certainly the people who are part of the Trump coalition for the racism. They would be harder to bring in and less desirable to bring in. But the people who have been who got excited about Trump because they thought there was going to be help for economically distressed communities. It seems to me that a Bernie message or a Mamdani message is much more effective in reaching those people than a sort of Hillary Clinton, Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, let's just keep doing what we've been doing for the past 60 years kind of message.
Yeah. And I think it's going to have to be one. And this kind of comes back to some earlier point you made about, you know, being in a generally liberal society. We have to develop a vision that's going to reflect the environment we're in, right? I've talked about it in terms of congruence, that you're not going to succeed with a message that doesn't land within that narrative sphere, within that ideological sphere. And so we do have a history of folks moving the needle in a more egalitarian, more libertarian in the proper sense way in American politics. You can point to the obviously the civil rights movement. You can look to figures of the past, Eugene Debs, his version of socialism, the municipal socialism that took root in the early 20th century in places like Milwaukee, Chicago, and elsewhere. You can point to someone we talked about before, Voltairine de Cleyre, offering a genuine American radicalism, or even, the Port Huron statement of SDS, which tried to create a new left that was more authentically American than the then seemed than was possible with some of the older left organizations, the older socialist and communist parties.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. All right, so let's—I mean, I think you kind of touched on this, but I just want to—I mean, I just want to kind of get your thoughts. You mentioned that the American political system, as designed, which has checks and balances, and I've been—you know—I've been reading Madison, and he's got paragraphs where he says, you know, make the legislature stronger, but it's too strong, so break it up, but then it'll be too weak, so. Give it, you know, certain powers in one of the houses and one of the other house, and they can side with the president against the other one. And just, you know, he just goes back and forth. It's kind of like the, you know, I know that you know that I know that you know. Like he's like, we're just gonna go back and forth with this, and then we'll figure out how the power will be balanced. And I mean, I'm not convinced that Madison's plan was perfect, but it does seem that the system found ways to balance power over the past, oh, I guess we're coming up on 250 years now. I forgot about the anniversary. And this is an unprecedented or unprecedented, to use an unfortunate meme, consolidation of power. To speak about Marjorie Taylor Greene, who I was thinking of already when you were talking, one of the things she mentioned was she just discovered that the Speaker of the House was not an independent member of Congress. He was just taking orders from the Trump administration. It seems like the Supreme Court is more or less just sort of taking orders from the Trump administration. So is that this is the problem? We just have a system designed to spread power out in good liberal fashion, and through cult of personality or whatever terms you want to use, the power is now consolidated.
We do have greater concentration of power, and that's been happening again, largely through the 20th century and into the 21st, where because of wartime, because of greater challenges, we've given more and more authority to the president, more and more authority to the bureaucracy, and expecting the courts to kind of save us when things get out of balance. And what Madison and the others never really counted on was that, first and foremost, that partisanship would trump everything, would override all the other checks and balances that were instituted in this system. It worked very, very well, but we've reached a point where our politics are so nationalized, so consumed by partisanship, and so what shall I say, calcified because of that partisanship, that it's not working in the way that Madison had intended. I think Madison and Democracy did kind of what it set out to do, which was to divide power and kind of keep it from oppressing folks, except for African Americans and Native Americans and others who weren't included in the system. But we were working toward expanding the pool of people who had some say in it. But this has been overridden. And that's part of the regime change. Another factor that I think is playing a role here has been the rise of the internet. Television was one challenge, but the internet and social media have been greater challenges and greater threats to that Madisonian vision of balanced democracy. So what do we do? Well, there are obviously several things that can be done. If you're staying within the system, there are some clear reforms that could be invoked that could remedy things. Instead of having, you know, single member districts, for example, for Congress, we could abolish those, have each state assign its representatives based on proportional representation, right? So we could have a statewide vote. Indiana, for example, gets 9 members of Congress. The top 9 vote getters, or rather, you know, if Democrats get 40% of the vote, they get 40% of those 9 seats, and do it that way so that we can represent people more than we represent territory. We could expand the number of people in the Congress. There's no reason we should have 535 or 435 in the House. We could have 600. We could have 800. That would allow for many more people to feel that they have some representation. We could bring about term limits in the Supreme Court. We could expand the number of justices. We can do all kinds of things that would make the system more representative, more amenable to change. We could revise the electoral system. We could have fusion voting. We could have, you know, instant runoff voting. We could have a variety of things like that that could improve the way the system functions and get past the what's called the partisan doom loop that we have. But beyond that, what we need to do, and this is important in any kind of moment of social and political change and upheaval, is that we need to be thinking about what are our values, what are our the kinds of mechanisms that could help us realize those values, and try to bring those into the conversation, even at the moment that we're trying to resist further deterioration of a system that was flawed anyway. But we have to save it in order to be able to move on to the next version. And that next version is what we need to be thinking about. We need to be collectively advancing ideas, even the simple reform efforts, but also the big ones, like how can we provide for more democratic agency? How can we provide for more mutual respect? How can we provide for a society that may well not have enough jobs for people? So do we go to universal basic income is, you know, a kind of question we need to be considering. So a variety of things like that. We need to be working on a two-track strategy, one of resistance to and saving our system, and the other is one of reconstruction, of moving forward in a different direction, try to press the reset button on our social and political life.
Yeah, I mean, I must admit, I'm fully convinced by this. Again, I think it's hard to have these two tracks when you're a radical. People, you know, it's much easier to say something like, well, what we just need to do is tear the system down and build something good up. That sounds nice. Anyone who listens to this podcast knows that that's not something that I think is going to happen anytime soon. On the other hand, you don't want to be a defender of the status quo. And look, politically these days, it seems like the defender of the status quo generally loses, at least in a presidential election. But I mean, philosophically, the status quo is tons of environmental exploitation. It's a world where meaningful work is reserved for the wealthy. It is a prison industrial complex, frankly, beyond the wildest dreams of any, say, 19th century authoritarian monarch. We have to defend the status quo against, you know, Trump's destruction of it, by which he wants to replace it with something much worse. And we need to reconstruct the status quo to be something better. And I I agree with you that it that makes it this two track system. I do think it's also, I think it's difficult to articulate this. It's right. Difficult to articulate this.
As difficult as it is to articulate it, it's difficult. It's even more difficult to put into practice. But the thing is that one thing that the most liberal democratic thinker, like say Robert Dahl, and the most radical thinker, like Peter Kropotkin, agree on is that you can have your revolution, but you've got to be thinking about what happens afterward. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we replicate the kind of tyranny that we saw under Bolshevism or Maoism or any number of others. Right. If you want a left populism, there are examples of left populists who've taken power, and a number of them have become as bad for ordinary people and for authentic political life as these radical right populists who come into power. So we need to be thinking about what happens after the revolution. We need to be thinking about, okay, how will decisions be made? What decisions will be made once we have that change, once the regime does change? What next? You know, those questions really can't be put off. Our tendency is to want to put those off and say, oh, it's, you know, it will be okay. We'll decide that later. You know, it's kind of the underpants gnome approach to politics and political change. We'll just put that off. It will just magically happen. And that's that kind of magical thinking, I think, is a lot of the problem with what's under being promoted today, right? Trump just says, you know, I solved eight wars. You know, it's all just magic. Or I will end the war in Ukraine on day one. No, I'll end it before I even take office, because it's, you know, it's magic. We want to avoid that magical thinking. We want to be realistic enough, yet hopeful enough. And perhaps not so much hopefulness that we need to be concerned about, but more about faith, more about faith in our fellow human beings who see the problems in more or less the same way that we do. Of, even though we allow for some variance, even though we allow for some continuum of opposition, not everybody has to be on the same page, not everybody has to be doing the same things or thinking about it in exactly the same way, but we do need to be thinking about it collectively, about what values we might have, values that we share, values that we want to implement. That's kind of the way I see things.
And then in the meantime, do we dare say that this is the most important election of our lifetimes or something like that? I mean, it just, I'm so allergic to this framing, but it does seem that we're coming up on these, I mean, we've still got 11 months, but these midterms, traditionally, the president's party struggles in midterms. I try and spend as little time on electoral politics as possible on this show, and yet here I am, just saying, you know, we've got to deliver a resounding victory for the Democratic Party in November of 2026. I don't want to say this, but I think this is true, is it not?
Well, I think such a victory would make it easier for people on the Republican side to disengage from the Trumpist cult, from the Trumpist control of that party. You know, both parties have coalitions that support them, of coalitions that constitute them. And those coalitions have cracks, have points of cleavage, points of conflict, points of dissensus, but they come together because they want to win, right? They want to be successful. They want to have power. Now, if it helps us put the Trumpist coalition behind us and move toward something a little more palatable, that's fine. But we shouldn't think again that that's going to be magic. I mean, that's the way people responded, unfortunately, to the Biden election in 2020. They thought, oh, Biden won. Okay, everything's cool. We don't have to worry about it anymore. That's not the way this works. You've got to be eternally vigilant. You've got to be constantly in action and attentive to potential sources of trouble, as well as potential opportunities for improvement.
So, I mean, it's again, it's back to the two tracks. We have to, speaking, I mean, maybe I shouldn't say this on this podcast. I am a registered Democrat in the state of North Carolina. We, as in the capital D Democrats, need to try and win this election. In the same time, we need to democratize, we need to socialize, we need to anarchize our political system. And it does seem that, a Democratic win in the midterms is a right step in this direction, but that is just one of the two tracks that we are working on. And maybe
Well,
I'm, go ahead. Yes.
I wouldn't put it as that as the tracks between electoral activity and everything else, but rather that electoral activity and success in elections is one among the many ways in which people can get active. So when you ask the question, what should we do in our current moment? The answer is something, anything, but do it. And for some people, it will be supporting a candidate, making the phone calls, doing the door knocking, providing money for campaigns. For other people, it's doing banner drops, it's blowing whistles on ice, and everything else. There's hundreds, if not thousands, of ways people can be active, people can get involved, people can find themselves and express themselves in political life. The important thing is that we do any or all of those, as many of them as we can collectively. But individually, it's going to be a matter of taste, a matter of commitment, an assessment of where you feel your energies are rewarded, what makes sense to you. So for some people it's writing, it's for other people it's calling legislators, for other people it's providing aid to the hungry, doing mutual aid projects. It can be any number of things that are possible. What we need to acknowledge then is that all of these are important, that collectively they all build capacity, they build senses of efficacy and engagement, they create social networks that are valuable for not only resisting oppression but overcoming it. That's why, we need to think about our history not in terms of the leaders, but in terms of movements, right? It's not just Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks, but it's all these unnamed people, people that were just out there, that stood in the sun, that maybe got beat over the head by the cops, and the same is true whether we're talking about, Selma, or we're talking about Seattle, or we're talking about Chicago, whatever it is, wherever it is, it's the accumulation of all these individual efforts that actually make the difference.
That's fantastic. I have nothing to add to that. All I need to say now is just, is there anything else you would like to leave us with, Leonard?
Now, I think I've said my piece.
All right. Thank you so much, Leonard Williams. Thank you for coming back on the podcast. It was such a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure talking with you again, Graham. Take care.